There's plenty of seats up here in the front, so if you would just... Very well. Why don't we go ahead and get started then? Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this symposium. My name is Maria Ferrer, and I'm the CEO of the Global Alliance for TB Drug Development, and I chair the Working Group on New Drugs for the Stop TB Partnership. It is my honor to introduce to you today our keynote speaker, Dr. Peter Small. His presentation is entitled Strengthening Laboratory Services for Today and Tomorrow. Dr. Small is a senior program officer for tuberculosis at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In this role, he is responsible for the development and implementation of the Foundation's tuberculosis activities. He received his bachelor's degree in chemistry from Princeton University, his medical doctorate degree from the University of Florida, and trained in internal medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. Prior to coming to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Dr. Small was on the faculty of Stanford University in the Division of Infectious Disease and Geographic Medicine. In this post, he was actively involved in research, teaching, and on patient care. For over a decade, the central theme of his research has been the nature and consequences of genetic variability within Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Dr. Small's original research has taken him to Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Europe, and has given him the opportunity to bring together teams of basic scientists, public health officials, and clinicians. His work couples new molecular biology tools with epidemiology, allowing him to address pragmatic questions about tuberculosis control. Some of you may not know that Peter is an accomplished scuba diver. And I'd like to think that this is a good analogy for the way he addresses problems. You see, Peter likes to go beneath the surface and get a different perspective. I guess, Peter, we can say that you like to take an in-depth perspective to things. In doing so, he challenges some, unsettles others, but inevitably he helps us find clever ways to chart new innovative paths. This is evident in his work at the Gates Foundation. From this perch, he has been instrumental in garnering a $900 million commitment for the tuberculosis program, an unprecedented sum of money to develop new diagnostics, prophylactics, and therapeutics for TB. Peter has a keen interest in the translation of scientific advances into tools that can improve human health. Those who have worked with Peter know that he's a meticulous thinker, a systematic scientist, and a committed colleague in the fight against tuberculosis. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Peter Small.
Thank you, Maria. I've attended this conference many times, but the last time that I gave the plenary address was about 9 years ago in my past life as a scientist. It's a funny activity to look back on your own words with the perspective of time. Predictions are particularly dangerous. For example, I predicted that in the time between this year, that year, and today, that DNA microarrays would identify mycobacterial genes of diagnostic utility, that industrial partners would capitalize on this knowledge to design new reagents, and that a salivary dipstick would replace the tuberculin skin test. I also predicted that latency would be understood as a distinct spore-like condition leading to rational advances in drug design and candidate drugs that would rapidly kill latent bacilli. And I predicted that scientific and political consensus would be reached that eradication is achievable. The impression one gets in reviewing these predictions is one of naivete. How hopeful and wide-eyed I was. So should the substantial failure of any of these predictions to become reality and embarrass me? No. It should embarrass all of us. Because every day that we fail to realize these and many other sought-after advances is a day in which we lose more ground to a disease that infects someone every second and kills 4 people every minute. In the hour that we'll spend in this session, more than 200 people will die of tuberculosis. There is no more compelling measure of the urgency of our work. The root of this epidemic is, at its core, a failure to diagnose. In his Nobel lecture delivered in 1905, Robert Koch spoke of the need to know who had the disease. In his words, "The starting point in the fight against all contagious diseases is the obligation to report, because without this, most cases of the disease remain unknown. It is not just a question of considerations applying to the sick here, but also the protection of the healthy." Robert Koch got it. You can't protect the health of the public if you can't diagnose the disease. But Koch went beyond that. Though his fame came in identifying the bacterium, much of his Nobel lecture was not about the pathogen, but what our understanding of the biology demanded of society. He called for, and I quote, "the establishment of centers where the patient's sputum is examined without cost for the tubercle bacilli. These could exist independently, or what is perhaps more practical, in association with hospitals, polyclinics, or with social welfare centers." And I would argue that in that sense, Dr. Koch was an early proponent of health systems strengthening. In the 100 years between then and now, our understanding of the disease has advanced to the point that tuberculosis is now preventable and curable. But this voice from 100 years ago makes completely clear our challenge today. We need to strengthen health systems so they may diagnose and treat tuberculosis. This disarmingly simple formula presents a formidable challenge because the reality is that our dysfunctional health systems labor with antiquated and inadequate diagnostic tests. The facts are familiar to all of you. We still rely on the microscopic examination of sputum, a 125-year-old method that detects roughly half of the cases in the best of circumstances, even fewer of those infected with HIV, and is fundamentally worthless for diagnosing children. Of the 22 countries with the highest TB burden, most have fewer than 3 laboratories in their entire national lab systems that can perform drug susceptibility testing. So as a result of these inadequate tools and systems, only a quarter of the TB cases in the world are ever really diagnosed and reported. And fewer than 5% of those with drug-resistant disease are ever identified. The sad reality is that delayed and erroneous diagnosis is the rule, not the exception. Certainly, we all understand that from a programmatic perspective, there is great peril in initiating therapy if we can't assure treatment completion. But somehow that legitimate and understandable concern has gotten perverted into an illegitimate and incomprehensible complacency about not diagnosing patients. And there is no downside to an accurate diagnosis. As I'll mention in a moment, the only risk is that we'll see that we have further to go than we'd like to admit. Reducing the diagnostic uncertainty that plagues our world requires that we develop better diagnostic technologies and strengthen our health systems to get existing tools to those who need them. Weak health systems are the pathogen's greatest ally. But what makes for a strong health system? It's actually fairly easy to articulate, as has been done by the Strategic and Technical Advisory Group. It is only six things. First of all, strong systems start with strong leadership and governance. That means having a strong capacity for health policy analysis and coordination between the entities that are responsible for planning, implementation, regulation, and enforcement. Two, strong systems need real financing, especially financing that helps to eliminate access barriers and that comes with genuine accountability. Strong systems need a strong workforce. That means a well-trained, well-supervised, and fairly compensated universe of healthcare workers. Four, strong systems have appropriate technologies. They have the ability to procure and distribute essential drugs, diagnostic tests, reagents, and equipment. Five, strong systems operate off of good information. This means having systems in place to collect vital statistics, having data on disease burden, patterns of healthcare utilization, and the ability to analyze these data. And finally, strong systems have mechanisms for health service delivery. Just as physicians were once admonished to know to heal thyself, too few health systems know thyself. Strong health systems need to know the number, the expertise, and the geographical distribution of their health providers. In practice, health system strengthening is a complicated task, and it's one where it's not easy to wrap our minds or our budgets around specifically what needs to be done. However, I would argue that in strengthening a health system, the lab system is an ideal point of entry. Lab systems and the diagnostic role they play make up a small percentage of health systems' budgets, approximately 3% overall. But that 3% guides the vast majority of spending, so that strengthening lab systems is a good investment and a great first step. If we do not make progress in strengthening health and laboratory systems, our progress against tuberculosis will stall. In fact, there's evidence that tuberculosis control is already stalling. Consider the all-too-typical scenario in the cycle of delayed diagnosis and disease propagation. A young woman begins coughing in any one of a dozen countries. It's just a cough, and she's pretty far from a medical clinic, so she does nothing or goes to a local pharmacist. When the symptoms continue, she finally goes to a medical clinic where she's probably misdiagnosed and treated for bronchitis or malaria. If she persists, she will eventually be asked to submit 3 sputum specimens. Stated differently, she will have been ill for months before getting a test that may well be wrong. In Malawi, more than a third of smear-negative patients make more than 6 visits to a health center before being started on therapy. If this woman's HIV positive, she may die before she ever gets her diagnosis. Again, in Malawi, fully half of TB suspects in whom a diagnosis was not readily made, died under investigation. And Tony, I'm not just picking on Malawi here. Autopsy studies from South Africa, Ivory Coast, Botswana, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, and India have all revealed tuberculosis as the leading cause of death in patients dying with HIV infection. The tragic reality for these people is that in the context of HIV, the failure to be diagnosed rapidly is all too often a death sentence. However, even in the best case scenario, a correct diagnosis leading to treatment, it will generally have been months since the coughing began. And by the time treatment renders her non-infectious, she will have already infected friends, co-workers, neighbors, and loved ones. We actually have an expression for this in the United States. It's called closing the barn door after the horses are out. This scenario, or one like it, is repeated millions of times each year. From this perspective, is it any surprise that we're seeing increasing evidence that TB control is stalling? There are numerous examples of stalling TB control. One is Vietnam, a country with one of the world's best tuberculosis control programs. They have exceeded the targets for case detection and treatment for nearly a decade, and yet they have seen no improvement in case notification rates. The same is true for several states in India. The tuberculosis community is a polite one. We rightfully brag about treating 26 million people with DOTS between 1994 and 2005. We focus on the observation that the global incidence rate is declining. However, we would prefer not to mention that prevalence and mortality are not being reduced quickly enough to meet the Millennium Development Goals by 2015. And virtually none of us acknowledge that this slow rate of decline in TB is swamped by the rate of growth in the human population, so that the actual number of people with tuberculosis, the only statistic that really matters, is increasing year after year after year. CREATE is a consortium of investigators, healthcare providers, government, industry, and policymakers who are conducting large-scale community randomized TB trials in South Africa and Zambia. It's a multi-year trial to see whether they can truly provide a package of diagnostics and intervention that promptly identifies those with disease and prevents disease in those who are infected. Although it's in the early stages, I was shocked to learn that in some of the communities they are surveying, that the TB prevalence rates are 2%. Again, the only risk of improved diagnoses is that we'll know in better detail the extent of the challenges we face. We are polite, and though it may be considered impolite to point out shortcomings, I contend that how far we have come means little without a candid assessment of how much farther we have to go. A hallmark of the global efforts to control tuberculosis is therapeutic rigor. Now, more than ever, we need a culture of diagnostic certainty. A clear diagnosis empowers health ministers to allocate resources effectively, healthcare practitioners to deliver care, and patients to demand the life-saving therapy they deserve. Misdiagnosis results in misallocation, malpractice, and death. This is especially true when it comes to tuberculosis, tuberculosis HIV, and multi-drug and extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis. A couple of years ago, several colleagues and I conducted a modeling exercise that showed the theoretical gains, assuming zero advances in treatment, that could come from improved diagnostics. We concluded that a rapid diagnostic test for active TB requiring no laboratory infrastructure with 97% specificity and at least 85% sensitivity could save roughly 400,000 lives annually or reduce the global TB mortality by one-fifth. That's what we could do in the future with a better test. And fortunately, there are some exciting advances coming down the pipeline. Already, the WHO has endorsed the use of liquid cultures in reference labs, which is much more sensitive than microscopy and quicker than conventional solid media. For the peripheral lab, we're close to having light-emitting diode fluorescent microscopes. This incremental improvement will cost no more than a light microscope and enables the same people in the same labs to improve their diagnostic accuracy by 10% and significantly increases their throughput. If the fluorescent microscope is an incremental improvement, the transformational improvement is the potential of DNA detection, such as the LAMP technology being developed by Find and Eichen. Robert Koch stunned onlookers by using staining reagents to allow people to look through a microscope and see tuberculosis. Reports from the time were that his audience were left stunned and silent, looking at the face of this killer. With DNA detection, we'll go beyond seeing the face of the killer. We'll actually be able to read its playbook. And in observing the language of life itself, we'll have a dramatic new opportunity to save lives. The pipeline for point-of-care diagnostics is less promising. And the cause of this thin pipeline is a lack of fundamental biological understanding. Here is where we need partnerships between basic researchers and clinicians to find answers to questions that have lingered for decades. What are the host and pathogen markers of infection, active disease, cure, and protection? Answering these questions requires a higher degree of collaboration than ever before. The best scientists with the most sophisticated laboratories working hand in hand with astute clinicians in endemic field sites. We need an entire globalized network of such connections from the bench to the bush and back again. An equally important result of the modeling paper that we wrote a couple of years ago was what it says about the progress that could be made by strengthening health systems to deliver existing diagnostic tests. The model showed that truly universal access to AFB microscopy would save about 133,000 lives annually. Stated another way, if our health systems could really deliver the tools that we have today, we would cut TB mortality by 8%. I can think of no more compelling argument for laboratory capacity strengthening. Better systems could save 133,000 lives next year. Better technology could save 400,000 lives each year in the future. To some, that statement may seem as if it requires a decision. Which path do we take? And what is Peter saying? A decade ago, he was here talking about better tests. Now he's here advocating for stronger health systems to deploy existing diagnostics. What I'm saying is that it's a false dichotomy. These two needs are not in competition with one another. They are totally synergistic. If we do a better job at delivering the existing tools, we will save lives. That is certain. In so doing, we will also be putting in place the infrastructure that is essential for the rapid adoption of the improved diagnostics of tomorrow. But to really use the tools we have better and to actually strengthen the health systems in advance of the introduction of new tools will require a shift in our thinking. I'm sure that some of you are familiar with William Easterly's book, The White Man's Burden. In it, he talks about the tragedy of third world poverty and notes that the fate of the world's poor is due as much to the ineffective efforts of those who care as it is to the inaction by those who are indifferent. He particularly takes aim at those he calls planners, the people who set goals, make regulations, and envision systems. He reserves high praise for those he calls searchers, those who respond to actual needs, are driven by results, and are accountable for what they accomplish. Ours is traditionally a community of planners. DOTS is a classic planner approach to TB. It's centrally driven, Geneva driven, Paris driven, The Hague driven, Washington, D.C. driven, dare I say, Seattle, Washington driven. It told us the five things we needed to do to control tuberculosis. I'm not nearly as down on planners as Easterly. Especially when it comes to TB, planning has set the standard. DOTS has successfully treated more than 26 million individuals worldwide, and in places where it is done well, TB rates are drifting down, and we don't see high rates of drug resistance. And there is a clear role for standards in scaling up lab strengthening. But planning is not the only path forward. DOTS has established what is essential, but not what is sufficient. It is now clear that our current approach to TB control has its limitations, especially among people living with AIDS, those with MDR-TB, migrants, nomads, and isolated populations. To address these kind of problems, we need to continue to reach out to searchers or adopt searching strategies ourselves. We need to realize that the big answer is that there is no big answer. To restate the obvious, one size does not fit all. We need to be open to innovation, to embrace an attitude that is based less on protocols and more of anything that works, works for us. Let me share an example of what that means in practice. Many of you know Mario Raviglione. Recently, Mario visited a mission belonging to the Archdiocese of the Bishop of Swaziland. It's in the middle of the Lowveld, the arid bush of the eastern part of the country, about 100 kilometers from the nearest city, the last 25 of which are down a rutted dirt road. Using funds provided by parishioners in the United States and Australia, they provide HIV and TB treatment. In administering care, they provide drugs in weekly amounts, or for those who need daily visits or are just starting on their antiretrovirals, the sisters travel to their homes. When you see Mario's photos, and I'm sure he'll show them to you if you ask, you realize that this is one of the many frontiers on which our battle is fought, rural places with widely dispersed populations. And you see that what works here are programs that recognize and react to the realities on the ground. Service integration isn't a policy, it's a necessity. Faith-based TB and HIV communities are one and the same. There is no distinction between community and home-based care. And by recognizing the necessities and the opportunities, these sisters are achieving the types of results in that one place that we need to achieve every place. Health systems are more than the pyramid of publicly owned facilities. It's a complicated network of private, informal, and faith-based institutions. All of these organizations and the affected communities themselves need to be engaged and strengthened so that we can save 133,000 more lives next year and 400,000 lives each year in the future. There is incredible knowledge and promise in this room and here at this conference. How much that promise translates into progress depends on the mindset we adopt as we leave. I began my remarks by mentioning my past life as an academic, and it's lessons from that past life that I believe can offer some guidance as we face our present challenges. I became involved in TB research during its resurgence in the United States in the early 1990s. The prevailing wisdom was that the epidemiology was driven by HIV-induced reactivation of latent infections that had been acquired in some other city or country. In short, transmission that occurred on somebody else's watch. Through molecular epidemiologic studies, I and others showed that in some places that resurgence was due to unrecognized ongoing disease transmission among the medically underserved in the United States. We faced skepticism, but ultimately we were able to re-energize and refocus TB control on this new set of facts, helping to turn the tide so that in the United States today, TB rates are at historical lows. There are two lessons that I took from that. The first is that you must face up to the realities of the problem and accept that they are likely to differ from place to place. The second was that getting to an effective response didn't stem from being complacent with the conventional wisdom about what was essential, but rather embracing innovation to seek local solutions that are truly sufficient. Just as the sisters Mario visited in Swaziland recognized the realities they faced would dictate the care they delivered, this thinking should guide all of us, whatever our role in fighting TB, whether we're here representing governments, non-governmental organizations, product developers, affected communities, funders, or implementers. We all face the same challenge, to not simply do what has been done before, but to ask if we would gain from doing more, to simultaneously be planners and searchers, to encourage innovation around you, and to be open to it when you see it. For some of you, that means seeking ways to get today's tools to more people. For others, it means working to develop tools for tomorrow. And for all of us, it means making sure health systems are strong enough to accommodate both. Above all, we need to be willing to judge our own efforts and the efforts of others, to encourage ambitious innovation, measure its impact, be brave enough to abandon what doesn't work, and aggressive enough to amplify what does. Should I be embarrassed about the failure of my predictions in that keynote address I delivered 9 years ago? No, because more than reputations are at stake here, lives are. What is the message we are sending to our patients when we say we aspire to diagnose 70% of cases? It says you're a statistic. We'd like to increase the odds that you're a good statistic, but we'll accept it if you're a bad one. I am deeply proud to be working for a foundation whose sole guiding principle is that every life, regardless of where that life is lived, is of equal worth. If I may paraphrase one of my bosses, Melinda Gates, when she spoke to the malaria community recently, she argued that low aspirations, quote, is just far too timid a goal for the age we're in. It's a waste of the world's talent and intelligence, and it is wrong and unfair to the people who are suffering from the disease. I'm also proud to be part of this community that has done an immense amount of good for a great many people and is dedicated to doing more. I'll be prouder still when we fulfill our true potential and, in heeding Robert Koch's call of a century ago, leave it for scientists a century hence to look back on our work from the vantage point of a world without tuberculosis. Creating that world will require today's tools in more hands, tomorrow's in more still, and a continued commitment to innovative thinking and pioneering action. We are no longer voices in the wilderness, as many of us once were. The world is becoming aware of tuberculosis, its prevalence, and the toll it takes. Political will, popular desire for action, funding mechanisms, they are all in place as never before. In this room is the power to harness that energy or stifle it. If we succeed in harnessing this energy, we can make more progress than ever before, perhaps even more than we ever thought possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Would anybody like to comment or ask a question of Dr. Small? He's kindly agreed to take some questions. And if you do, would you please come to the microscopes that are positioned in the middle of the...
Good morning. My name is Ruth McNerney. I'm based at London School of Hygiene Tropical Medicine. I don't know if most people are aware at that MIS meeting that the Stop TB Working Group, the Partnership on New Diagnostics, has a new structure. And there's now a subgroup on point-of-care diagnostics. I'm sorry, I'm getting terrible echo. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Good. And so this is just an ad, basically. It's a partnership. We want it to be broad. We know there's some very exciting new technologies out there, but we need more funding. And I see one of the most important group roles of the partnership is to lever more funding. So I'm asking the help, everyone in this room, let's go to NIH. Let's go to the funders who've been funding beautiful academic research, but don't really yet fund translational research. Please, can we shift the money in the direction? This is risky. Some of the technologies may not work, but we only need a few that do, and we'll make progress. So please, get in touch, build networks. But everyone, start nagging the funders, start nagging your governments. Let's put the money to where it's going to make best use. Thank you.
Ruth, I think it's beautifully said, and I would only make one minor modification, and I think that the issue with funders is not about shifting resources, it's about growing the pot. It's not that we can afford, with the meager funding that we have for basic research, to shift that into something else. It's time that research for all of the activities that are essential for our mission to be fully funded. I totally support that.
Absolutely. I couldn't echo that better. Peter, you talked about innovation and the mindset that it will take. It seems to me that that's easier said than done. How do you transform? How do you create transformation while you're trying to get to patients, get care, make your unit survive? I mean, it's a hard thing to do.
I'm sure it is, and I'm quite sure that I can't make it happen. So, but I think that it's the people in this room that can make it happen, because it's really this decentralized innovation of trying new things, measuring their impact, and then amplifying what does that is really the opportunity of such a large and diverse group as is brought together at this meeting.
Hi, Peter. It's John. One, I'd like to thank you for your support of laboratory system strengthening. Many people may have heard at this meeting the laboratory, or formerly known as the subgroup, we are proposing a global laboratory initiative. This is really a big challenge. Some of us still have to be planners to make this work. And this really is trying to focus on how can we do this in an integrated way. What is that series of activities that really will try to meet this challenge of strengthening laboratories? But I'd like to thank you for stating this so eloquently.
Thank you.
Yes.
Alex Pym, South Africa. Peter, can you share your predictions for 9 years' time with us now?
Well, one thing I've learned in the last 9 years is to be cautious about one's predictions. No. I haven't any idea. I mean, I think that it is so dependent on what the people in this room and who share the vision of the people in this room do, that it's absolutely impossible for me to make predictions about 9 years hence. I think what's clearly going to happen is that there's groundswell of attention that global health and TB is getting is going to fundamentally change the trajectory of our accomplishments to date. I think that there are lots of tactical strategic issues along the way in terms of how we articulate and how we achieve those goals. But I'm also quite confident that the predictions that I made 9 years ago will in fact come true, because I have a profound faith in the power of science and technology to change our lives.
Peter Davis, I'm looking through this microscope, but I can't see any bugs at the end. That was a lovely malaprop. Thanks, Maria, for that. Peter, that was a wonderful talk, but there was one quote right at the beginning which really summed it all up, and that was, you said something like, the cause, or the root cause of this epidemic is a failure in diagnosis. Would that be fair?
That's true.
Because I've always been thinking, well, maybe it's a failure of treatment. Maybe it's a failure of society to equip people with enough immunity through better housing and so on. But you've come right down and said it's diagnostics, which we've got to be spending our money on in the next decade or so. Does that mean that you want to divert from new drugs, from vaccines? Because we can't do everything all at once.
Why?
Can we do everything all at once?
I think we have to. You know, I think that this gets to the ambition issue. You know, it's why are we sitting in this room talking about what program we're going to cut so that we can actually go to scale with a program that's important? I think it's time that we all just change our ambitions and our attitudes to say that we actually absolutely, definitely need a new drug, a new diagnostic, a new vaccine, stronger lab health systems. We need to better deliver all the care. It's all of this stuff that needs to happen, and I don't know why we should settle for less than enough resources to do it all, because that's what it's going to take.
I quite agree. I just wanted you to say that. Thanks.
Hi, this is Mark Perkins from FIND. I'd like to take up the challenge of making some predictions from 9 years hence. I predict that we will have microscopy methods that will be simpler and more sensitive than existing microscopy methods, that will have molecular methods that can diagnose TB quickly and relatively easily at levels of the health system that are substantially lower than we can currently do molecular testing, even at the microscopy level, and that we will be easily able to detect drug resistance with molecular methods that do not require DSL3 or other high safety level training and conditions, and that these technologies will all be developed, evaluated, and of proven efficacy and be available for use. Now, what I can't predict is whether or not the partnerships that we are forming now will be strong enough that those technologies will be rolled out and available for people all around the world and accessible in ways that will make these 400,000 lives savable in the short term, and that's what we need to focus on.
Thank you.
Peter, I want to push maybe not a prediction, but I'm going to take the last few minutes to ask you, if you could draw the picture, if I'm a patient in 2018, how would I be treated? Where would I go? How would diagnostics be different? And what would I do about my children? Paint me a picture.
I don't think I can paint a picture, because what we're really talking about is embracing the full diversity of the world, so that we have to, I think, get beyond thinking of a patient, a test, and start recognizing that we're talking about 9 million patients in equally many different settings, and that if that patient is in a urban setting, that there will have a very different experience than if they're in a Bedouin tribe. But regardless, the common theme for all of them will be that the same sense of therapeutic rigor that they can get now when they're at a DOT center would extend to a sense of diagnostic certainty, so that they know that when they leave that health setting, that if they're told that it's not TB, it in fact is not TB. And if they're told that it is TB, they'll know that it's drug sensitive or resistant, and they'll be on the right therapy. So I think the only common theme that I'd like to harp on is this issue of diagnostic certainty.
Great. Terrific. Any other questions or thoughts? Thank you, Peter, very, very much.